Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Horizon CMS Healthcare versus Hall.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Cooper will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Brent Cooper. I represent Horizon CMS in this case. One of the primary issues that's before this court today is whether or not, under our medical malpractice statute, particularly the cap that's contained there, punitive damages should be covered within the cap or included within the cap.
Now, presume with me, if you will, that the term civil liability for damages is ambiguous. Just make that assumption. What public purpose is served, what public policy purpose is served by including punitive damages within the cap?
You go back to the original findings that are set forth in Section 11, excuse me, 1.02 of the original Act. There were two distinct purposes that were being addressed by the legislature in 1977. One was...
My question is, what public policy purpose would be served by construing that language to include punitive damages?
By allowing the citizens of the state of Texas to be able, one, to have health care, two, at an affordable price.
And where in the legislative history did the legislature consider the effect of punitive damages in that regard?
The term punitive damage, if you go through the legislative history, is not per se mentioned. However, some of the examples that were given by the sponsors of the bill clearly indicate they are contemplating punitive damages. The one we put in our brief was a situation where it was described that if someone goes in for surgery to amputate one leg...
We're going the same direction.
Okay.
My understanding of the purpose of the legislation was a health insurance liability crisis.
More than that.
Okay, where do you find that it was more than that?
If you go to section, for example, section 1102, subsection 6A6, it talks about the fact that certain physicians would not go into certain practices, they would not practice in certain areas of the state because of the fear of lawsuits and the fear that their personal assets may be exposed. It was beyond just an insurance crisis, it was the fact that obstetrics, gynecology back in 1977, other areas where there were high risk, there was difficulty in getting physicians to practice in these certain areas because of the risk of liability, regardless if the liability was covered by insurance or whether or not they had to pay it out of their own pocket.
Would you agree that if the purpose of the legislation was solely to address an insurance crisis, that your position would be much weaker?
I don't agree with that. I could not agree with that because, again, one of the things, you've got to look at what they did in 1977. There were two parts of House Bill 1048. One was 4599, but the other addressed the insurance crisis, which is Article 5.15-1 of the insurance code. And one of the things they did, and you've got to balance these two, was in Section 8 of 5.15-1, they put a provision which said policies of liability insurance for medical health care providers can cover punitive damages.
And what's the public policy purpose behind that section?
To reduce the cost of the insurance for the practitioners. One way to reduce the cost of the insurance is not to have...
But how does that serve, again, the public policy purpose behind it?
Well, the public policy in reducing the cost of insurance is that those costs will not be passed on by the hospitals, by the physicians, or whomever else to the customers, and we'll have affordable health care and safety.
And what about the public policy behind allowing punitive damages to deter gross and willful mistakes?
We still do allow punitive damages under our interpretation. The only problem is, or the only issue is $1,400,000 plus all of your medical expenses, plus all of your hospital expenses, is that going to be a deterrent?
Well, Mr. Cooper, in terms of looking at that particular issue, in a case such as this, the fact remains that given the amount of actual damages that were awarded, you agree that under Texas law, one of our tests for the appropriateness of punitive damages is the proportional relationship between the punitives and the actuals.
The court has employed that in the past in the common law, and that's been carried out.
And arguably, in a case like this or in many other cases, a party would either be precluded from recovering punitives if they're included in the cap, or would be severely restricted in the amount they could recover.
They would be reduced to the amount of the cap, correct. but no question about
that. So this would be a severe limitation on the ability to recover punitive damages.
Well, I'm not so sure it's any more severe. Again, you look at 41.008 or 007, whatever the current version is, where it's two times your economic losses. I mean, look in this case. If you employ that, the economic losses in this case were very, very slim. Now, we were not under the new statute. We were under the old statute. Plus, your non-economic damages up to $750,000, we have some effect there.
But at the same time, it is tied to the amount of actual damages at that point in time as opposed to just a restriction that is placed.
To certain actual damages, not all actual damages.
But
it's just
would, it, but with your theory, though, it does produce a rather anomalous result. The more serious the injury, the less punishment you would receive. The less serious energy, the potential for the greater punishment you can receive.
It would depend upon the, when you talk about the more serious the injury, it would depend upon the nature of the damages sought. For example, if someone was hospitalized and they had, you know, $2 million in medical care or hospital bills, they would still be entitled to recover those in addition to the $1.3 or $1.4 million that would be available.
But the $1.4, but I guess I may be misinterpreting it, but it seems to me the way the statute is drawn, the limit, the cap was really designed to limit pain and suffering, the intangible damages. You could get your medical, you could get your expenses, but it was going to limit all the intangibles that you would otherwise get from a personal injury.
The original version of the cap, when it was through the Keating Committee, and the original versions had the cap limited to merely mental anguish and pain. Later on, it was revised to distinguish between economic versus non-economic damage. The final version that was put to the committee that was passed talked about civil liability for damages. We would be gone through, the legislature had gone through all those machinations as far as economic loss, non-economic loss, mental anguish, non-mental anguish. They came to the point where we are today, and that was civil liability for damages.
And so my point is, the more significant the injury, the less the punishment. Because if punitives are part of the cap, and you have severe crippling injuries, and the only thing that's accepted from the cap is strictly your medical expenses, then you've got all these other economic damages, life affecting damages that come under the cap, and therefore the punishment for intentional or gross negligence is less the more severe the injury than if it's not as severe an injury, and therefore there's much more area in the cap within which to punish.
I think under certain circumstances that can be true, but that's the same that's true under Article 41.07 today, the punitive damage cap, where it is limited to two times your economic losses plus your non-economic losses up to $750,000 or $700,000. Again, if someone has tremendous non-economic losses or whatever, as a proportional basis, it's going to be less.
But if they have high economic losses, then they're going to be able to recover.
If they have high economic losses, they would be entitled to recover those as well. Of course, in this case, the only economic losses we dealt with were the medical bills, which were applied on top of the cap.
Counsel, a lot of pages have been devoted to attempting to define damages. Reliance has been made upon dictionary definitions. Reliance has been made upon what other statutes define damages to mean and what other cases have said concerning other statutes, such as Azar and Nutt. And I don't recall seeing either your brief or the respondent's brief reference Section 103B, which says that any legal term or word of art used in this part, I take that to mean this particular statutory provision, not otherwise defined, shall have such meaning as is consistent with the common law. Is there any reason why that does not apply?
I believe it does apply.
All right. And I don't recall, again, seeing either your side or the respondent's side provide to us any Texas common law definitions of damages as they existed in 1977, which is when this was passed.
Well, I probably guarantee that both sides have looked through probably every case that has defined damages. and I'm trying to recall if there is one that has dealt with a common law definition of damages. Again, most of the ones, from my recollection that we found, dealt with the term as it's been defined. Well, for example, Azar not used the term damages.
But that dealt with the statutory.
But there was no statutory definition of the term damages, and this court was then required to go into, I assume, some common law construction and say, okay, what does damages mean? And I think you specifically put it out, for it's there in a vacuum with no surrounding definitions. What does the term, quote, damages mean under Texas law?
I found one, which is a court of appeals case out of Tyler, 1970. It says the term damages is defined as the sum of money the law awards as pecuniary compensation, recompense, or satisfaction for an injury done or a wrong sustained as a consequence of either a breach of a contractual obligation or a tortious act. Would you agree that if that is appropriately reflective of the common law definition of damages, at the time this particular statute was passed, that you lose on your punitive damages claim?
I could not agree, because you're omitting two other words that are part of 11.02, and that is civil liability for damages. And again, I think you've got to read those four words together, and there are cases and there are definitions. I think we've quoted to the court the Black's Law definition as far as civil liability, which includes the concept of double, treble, or multiple damages as well. And again, if you look at the term civil liability, it means the liability that you will have to pay as part of a judgment.
I would like to request both you and the respondent to submit post-submission briefing on the common law definition of damages at the time this statute was passed. And in that regard, let me ask another question that you raised in your reply brief, if I recall, and I'd be interested in what the other side says also, and that is, so this statute was reenacted in 93, was it?
August 31st, 1993, section, I think it's chapter 625. This by its own terms, when it was passed in 1977, it was set to expire in 1993. And it would have expired in 1993, but for the legislature reenacting it and giving it breathing new life in the statute.
Yes. So with it reenacted in 93, perhaps we should look at the definition.
At 94,
right.
Which then Azar Nutt was, I believe, in 87, which I believe, even though the court was construing a statute, it was construing a term of the statute in a vacuum and looking through prior definitions of what the term damages meant.
Mr. Cooper, you represented the Rose defendants in the Rose versus Doctors Hospital case, correct?
That is correct.
And did you not take the position in that case that the damages cap does not in any way attempt to limit the recovery of punitive damages?
Well, I believe the brief that was attached was sort of incomplete. If you look at the entire brief, which I assume is on file with the court, you'll see that the signature page was indeed by a former partner of mine, Mr. Mike Huddleston. He did have my name on the brief, but that brief was one that was offered by Mr. Huddleston. In fact, it was signed by Mr. Huddleston.
So you disagree with that position?
I disagree with that position. In fact, I didn't know he said that until they brought that to our attention. But regardless, again, dicta in brief or dicta in opinions, the question is, what did the legislature in 1977 or 1993 mean when it put the term damages out there?
Would that have been the first time you've ever taken an inconsistent position?
Well, I'm not going to say that, John, because as an advocate, I have to the extent that it's within the boundaries of the law, on a good faith basis, I have an obligation to argue what's in my client's best interest. And so I'm not going to make that recommendation to the court. But going on, as far as the term damages, you know, one of the things I think is important is 11.02b. And that is that the legislature carved out from the cap certain types of damages. The legislature knew how to carve out certain types of damages, and in fact carved out medical expenses and hospitalization expenses. And there is a line of authority in this state which says basically that if you have, in fact, there was a case involving the medical malpractice statute, the Townsend versus Catalina ambulance case, and the question was whether or not ambulance case companies should be included as a health care provider. And I believe it was the Corpus Christi court said, well, there's a whole list of who health care providers are. and the fact that the ambulance companies are not listed in the health care provider list is evidence that the legislature didn't intend for them to be covered. And we believe the same argument applies with respect to 11.02b, that is, that there is a list of damages which are to be excluded from the cap, and the fact that punitives are not included in the list is evidence that the legislature intended for punitive damages to be covered by the cap.
Is there any reason you did not rely upon 1103?
As far as the alternative measure?
Right.
Well, the reason we did not rely upon the alternative measure was because of the Rose case, the fact that the court in Rose found that there was severable, the issues were severable. That is, you could carve out from the 1102 cap a wrongful death case. We believe that a severable claim is statutory in nature. It was passed by the legislature in 1895. It is not common law. It is not subject to the open courts doctrine. And the same severability argument that was present in the Rose case would also be present in this case, and that the court could and should rely upon 11.02 as opposed to 11.03.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Charles Gilmore will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, there are two threshold issues that the court must address before it ever gets to the issue of what Article 4590 does and does not cap. The first is whether the court can separate the application of the cap to survival claims from what the court struck down in Lucas, that is, the cap's application to a common law claim for a live patient's personal injuries. The second threshold issue is whether Horizon is entitled to the cap in light of its failure to establish its health care liability, its health care provider status. Now, before I address those issues, let me address the issue that is, the court has directed most of its questions to, and that is the scope of the cap in relation to punitive damages. There are three reasons the court should hold that punitive damages have been excluded from the cap. First, the plain language of the cap excludes punitive damages. The legislative history shows that the legislature never intended to cap anything other than compensatory damages. And third, subjecting punitive damages to the cap would lead to absurd and even unconstitutional results that the legislature never intended, much less envisioned, frankly.
You agree that in the legislative history there was no mention made at all, one way or the other, concerning punitive damages?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that.
Can you point me specifically to where punitive damages were by name referenced?
Your Honor, we don't get to this punitive damages mentioned by name until 1987, when the TMA was at the legislature with legislation directed at the cap, seeking a constitutional amendment aimed at making the cap constitutional. And at that point, the TMA represented to the legislature, in support of its legislation, that the cap does not in any way apply to punitive damages. That was at the same time that the cap, that the punitive damages capping statute was pending before the legislature. And once that statute was passed, the TMA commented to its membership, explained the benefit of that cap to its membership, and said, prior to the passage of the 1987 statute, there was no cap on punitive damages. The punitive damages were unrestricted. And we provided the court with an oral argument handout, exhibits, and we've summarized some of the key items of legislative history referred to in our brief. I direct the court to the exhibit under tab 2, where that is found. But in 1977, Your Honor, when those who were charged with the obligation of explaining the scope of the cap, like Dean Keaton himself, those who were charged with the obligation of making sure the cap became law, like TMA's bill sponsors, when they explained the scope of the cap, they limited its scope to compensatory damages. Now, that's absolutely consistent with another key item of legislative history the court has before it, and that is the House Study Group's bill analysis of the cap. And the bill analysis shows that the cap was understood to be a limitation on damages to pain and suffering and damages for economic losses such as lost earnings. Now, the legislature's reference in 1977 to compensatory damages was really founded or rooted in the Keaton Commission's discussion of damages as a cause of the insurance crisis. And under tab 1, we've summarized on the right-hand column the relevant finding that the Keaton Commission made regarding damages. It's actually quoted. It's not summarized. The relevant finding that the King Commission made regarding damages as a cause of the insurance crisis focused exclusively on compensatory damages. Punitive damages were found to have nothing to do with the insurance crisis. And I direct the Court's attention to the last sentence there. We've highlighted it in red, where the King Commission said, the Study Commission has for convenience lumped damages into three categories: pain and suffering, expenses, and loss of earnings. If you look at the history of the statute as it made its way through the legislature in 1977, those were the three items of compensatory damages that were consistently referred to by anyone who commented on the scope of the cap. Now, that's absolutely consistent with the purposes of the statute. The purposes of the statute was to address an insurance crisis. It had nothing to do with punitive damages. Insurers were paying compensatory damage awards, and those compensatory damage awards were driving up the cost of insurance for the health care providers, which resulted in the denial of health care to average citizens. Now, punitive damages were not being paid by insurance carriers back then. That's why Dean Keaton didn't mention them in the Keaton Commission's findings regarding damages as a cause to the crisis.
If they weren't being paid by carriers, why was it necessary to pass legislation at the same time this legislation was passed to prohibit insurers from providing punitive damage coverage for medical providers?
Well, there's two responses to that. That recommendation came directly from the Keaton Commission's report regarding damages as a cause of the insurance crisis. Part of that report dealt with damages as a cause of the insurance crisis, and it focused exclusively on compensatory damages. There was another part of the report that recommended passing this legislation that would say providers cannot be covered for punitive damages. And the reason had nothing to do with the crisis, had nothing to do with insurance carriers paying those damages. The King Commission found that unless providers paid those damages, it would defeat the purpose of punishment.
You just got through saying they weren't ever paying them. They were paying them anyway. I thought that was Justice Abbott's question, that the insurance companies had not been paying.
Exactly.
So why do you need a statute that says they can't when they hadn't been anyway?
Because the point of that statute was, as they looked at the punitive damages, they were unless the insurer, unless the provider was made to pay those damages, that would defeat the purposes of punishing the terms.
Is that in the legislative history?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Actually, it's better than legislative history because the findings of the Keaton Commission were adopted.
Well, I mean, that finding that the purpose behind the insurance provision was to put the onus of punitive damages on the provider.
Absolutely. When the findings of the Keaton Commission were adopted, specifically adopted in the section 1.03b4 of the statute, that's one of the findings that's set forth in the Keaton Commission's findings, the findings regarding the purpose of punitive damages. And as a matter of fact, there's legislative history on this, Your Honor, about the purpose behind that section disallowing providers to obtain coverage for punitive damages. Representative Robert Davis, who was also a member of the Keaton Commission, this is in our brief, commented on that the punitive damages were not being paid by insurers, and that this was enacted as a fail-safe device, simply to make sure that that was the case. Another thing the court should consider, and this is the third reason I would ask the court to hold the punitive damages have been excluded from the case, is that the results that would obtain are absurd. In this case, the conduct was so egregious, the harm inflicted was so severe, that the actual damages have exhausted the cap. And yet, the jury assessed punitive damages, in fact, a large amount of punitive damages, $90 million. And while that finding of $90 million has never been challenged as excessive or otherwise challenged as inappropriate, Horizon's come up with a instruction of the statute, it would mean it doesn't have to pay a cent of punitive damages. In fact, the more severe the injury is inflicted, the less likely it is that grossly negligent and even intentional wrongdoing would have to pay a cent of punitive damages. Now, that's absurd.
Since damages were not specifically identified in the Act, do you have any reason why Section 103B should not govern and dictate what we determine to be the definition of damages?
Well, 2 points on that. At the Court of Appeals, Horizon took the position that the term damages was not a legal term or word of art subject to that provision. It's a footnote in their appellant's brief, so that's why the parties have never really looked at that issue. And we were satisfied with that because the dictionary definitions uniformly define the term damages as compensation for injury or loss.
Don't you think the word damages is a legal term?
I think it could be read as a legal term.
And so, if we determine damages to be a legal term, would you agree that Section 103B governs the definition of damages?
If the court determines that damages is a legal term, then the statute instructs the court to employ the common law to define that term.
And being that the statute was reenacted in 93, why would the court's definition in Azar Nutt not be dispositive?
Two things about that. First of all, I don't think the statute was reenacted. I quarrel with the notion that that's a reenactment of the statute. What happened was the statute, House Bill 1048, did a number of different things, and at the end of it, it had a provision that said this bill expires on August 8, 1993. What the legislature did in 1993 was simply to say, amend that one provision and say, no, it's going to be 2010. And I'm not sure whether that falls within the Code of Construction Act's definition of a reenactment.
You know, they made changes to it.
They did make changes. They amended it. They amended it in 1993.
Right.
Now, with respect to Azar Nutt, Azar Nutt is not a plain meaning case. Azar Nutt, you look at Azar Nutt, and what the majority based its holding on was the legislative history of 8307C. And the legislative history that the court looked at in that case led the court to conclude that the term damages, as used in that provision, as granted a cause of action, should include punitive damages. The legislative history in this case produces the opposite result. There is no legislative history saying that the legislature ever intended to cap anything other than those damages that were causing the insurance problem, compensatory damages. Now, the court should consider another aspect of this whole thing, the constitutionality of cap. If the court subjects the cap or says the punitive damages are subject to the cap, in a wrongful death case, where actual damages are found and they exhaust the cap, and yet the jury assesses punitive damages, according to Horizon, no amount of punitive damages can be assessed. Yet Article 16, Section 26 of the Constitution guarantees in a wrongful death case for gross neglect to a spouse or a child the right to recover the remedy of punitive damages. Now, this court said in General Chemical Court versus Daylon that the legislature lacked the authority to, by statute, increase those who are entitled to recover punitive damages beyond the scope of those who are specifically referred to in the Constitution, spouses and children. Yet if the court, by the same token, the legislature necessarily lacks the authority to, by statute, eliminate those to whom the Constitution guarantees a right of punitive damages. And that's the context in which the discussion of punitive damages was raised in Rose, because it was a problem. It would be a problem to the court, I think, with respect to Rose, because the constitutionality, the court held in Rose, yes, we can constitutionally apply this cap to wrongful death claims, but what do we do with punitive damages? Where punitive damages are assessed in a case like this, where the actual damages exhaust the cap, punitive damages couldn't be awarded. And I think that raises serious questions about the viability of Rose if the court wants to subject punitive damages to the cap. Now, the court, this is not a wrongful death claim, and I'm aware of that. This is a survival claim. But the legislative history shows that the legislature was very concerned about the constitutionality of the cap from a number of perspectives. Equal protection, open courts, the right to a trial by jury. But there's no history. There's no analysis or discussion in the history of the cap in relationship to Article 16, Section 26, which guarantees the right to punitive damages. And that's not because Dan Keaton didn't know that was there. That's because the legislature did not read the cap to apply to punitive damages. I would ask the court to hold that this cap does not apply to punitive damages. Now, my time remaining, I want to turn to another key issue before the court, and that's the separability issue. Now, this court struck down the cap's application to the cap to a live patient's claim for personal injuries in Lucas. That ruling necessarily struck down the cap as applied to all applications that cannot be severed from that application. That application the court struck down in Lucas. 3 years later in Rose, the court had addressed the issue, can we sever out wrongful death claims from the cap's application to common law claims? The court said, yes, we can, based on the application to the Western Union test. Applying that test, the court framed the issue as this. Would the legislature, in 1977 had passed a cap that applied to wrongful death claims in the absence of any cap on a live patient's claim? The court said yes, and it answered the question by pointing out that a health care liability claim is, the cap applies to a health care liability claim, and the health care liability claim is a claim for injury to or death of the patient. And the court read into that the legislature's express distinction between those two claims a legislative intent that would permit it to sever out the cap's application to wrongful death claim. Then the court went on and held, yes, it applying the cap to wrongful death claims doesn't violate open courts, doesn't violate due process. Now, this case involves a survivor claim. This court has said that a survivor claim is a claim for personal injuries. It is a deceased person's claim for personal injuries that's kept alive by the survival statute. This court has said that the survival statute did not create a new cause of action, but simply kept alive the patient's cause of action and vested it in the patient's estate. What the court found dispositive in Rose is absent here. The health care liability claim definition says that it applies to the cap applies to a claim for injury to or death of a patient. A survival claim is a claim for injury to the patient. It falls within the language that the court in Rose looked at and said, when we strike out the cap's application to an injury claim, we're left with something that we can uphold, a wrongful death claim. And the legislative history supports our position that the legislature never intended or envisioned the cap being applied separately to survival claims in the absence of its application to a live patient's claim for personal injuries. The legislature referred to those claims as one inseparable claim for injury to the patient. Now, the result that would obtain of holding, yes, we can sever out the cap, is depicted, Your Honors, under tab 3. I direct the court's attention to that page, if I could. Verizon's position in this case is that the legislature intended to subject punitive damages to the cap. They're also telling the court that, yes, we can sever out the application of the cap from what was struck down in Lucas to a survival claim. And, of course, the Rose Court severed out the application of the cap to a wrongful death claim. Verizon's position, necessarily, is that the legislature would have passed a cap that looked like this. Well, the first issue that the court must decide, or anybody who's trying to apply the cap, is the patient dead? If the answer is yes, then the claim that we get to a next level of inquiry. Is it a wrongful death or is it a survival claim? If the answer is no, well, under Lucas, we have uncapped actual damages and uncapped punitive damages. If it's a wrongful death claim, under Rose, actual damages are capped. But if it's a wrongful death claim where punitive damages are assessed, they may not, but the cap may or may not apply to the punitive damages, because our Article 16, Section 26 guarantees the recovery of punitive damages. And depending on the amount of actual damages awarded, they may or may not be allowed to award any amount of punitive damages, which would result in an unconstitutional application of the cap in a wrongful death claim. But then when we get to survival claims, according to Verizon, the cap can apply to both actual damages and punitive damages. So what we're left with is this sort of a patchwork quilt of a cap that takes a flow chart, really, to understand. And the inquiry that the court, I think, must address, frankly, that Verizon has to answer is, where is the proof that the legislature ever intended this result? That the legislature would have created a cap that did this? I submit to the court it's not there. There is no proof. This, frankly, the statute is not severable between this unconstitutional application to a live patient's claim and its arguably constitutional application to a survivor. And in that case, it's void as to both. And I would ask the court to hold that the statute is void as applied to Mark Party survivor. I guess I'll tender back my time.
Well, I'll check up a little bit. All right. The Court of Appeals ruled your way with regard to the punitive damage cap. And this is the way they calculated it. They said to compute the reduction, you talk about the trial court, for the trial court to compute the reduction, the court multiplied by 4 the jury's uncapped actual damages award
of $2,370,000 and change. My question is this. Assuming that the court rules that the $500,000 cap, as it has been enhanced through the Consumer Price Index or whatever, assuming that that does not cap punitive damages, my question is, why wouldn't punitive damages be calculated from otherwise capped actual damages as opposed to uncapped actual damages? And before you answer that, let me ask a predicate question. That is that an issue that the petitioner preserved up here?
Not at all. That was an issue that was presented to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals correctly followed the law that has interpreted the four times actual damages cap. And the law, the Court of Appeals cases that interpret the term actual damages from that four times actual damages cap have uniformly held that the term actual damages means the actual damages found by the jury actually suffered by the patient before the court applies some statutory reduction. And I believe it's the I Gotcha case from Fort Worth, where it involved a credit that the defendant was entitled to. And the argument there was, well, you need to take out that credit first, and then you can multiply, because I think you're going to get the credit. But you need to take out the credit from the actual damages and then multiply. The court said no. That's a very persuasive analysis of why. The answer is no. You have to look at the actual damages that the patient actually suffered and multiply that times four. And again, the predicate answer, or the answer to the predicate question is, that has not been preserved. There's no issue on appeal that would relate to, that they have raised to that petition. Now, the way you started that question out was, trial court awarded the cap that we asked them to award, or something along those lines. We are not, it is our position that Verizon has waived the benefit of that cap, Your Honor.
I don't recognize that.
All right.
Any other questions, counsel?
I would like to address four points. One is the statement that the legislature never envisioned the cap applying to survival claims. I'd refer the court to section 11.05, which says the cap applies notwithstanding the provisions contained in the local death statute or the survival statute. Specifically, it says that. Second thing he says is, well, how can you apply, if the cap should not be constitutionally applied to a survival claim? This court in Ballard versus Maxwell said that survival claims, when a person died, their cause of action died with them, and the only way they have a cause of action is but for the survival action, resurrecting those claims. As a result, it's statutory. As a result, the open courts clause does not follow or does not apply, and therefore 10.01, which was the issue in Ballard versus Maxwell, can constitutionally be applied. That argument likewise has been rejected. The other question is, well, was there ever intent for the legislature that punitive damages be capped? And this is one of the arguments I didn't get to earlier, but again, 11.05 says the cap applies notwithstanding the wrongful death statute or the survival statute. And if you look at our wrongful death statute, one of the elements of 71.009 that is specifically provided for in the wrongful death statute are punitive damages, where there has been death caused by gross neglect, intentional lie. And so we have the legislature saying that we're going to apply this cap regardless of what is contained in the wrongful death statute, which contains a specific provision for punitive damages. Azar Nutt, again, what the court said, looking at damages alone, we believe it's broad enough to cover punitive damages.
Mr. Cooper, let me direct your attention back to the insurance code provision that prohibits insurers from insuring health care providers against punitive damages.
Right.
If your opposing counsel is correct that the public policy purpose to be served by that provision is to hold the provider personally responsible for intentional or willful misconduct, then how is that purpose served by your interpretation?
By this. If you adopt their interpretation, what they're saying is, in order to encourage doctors to stay in Texas, to practice certain areas of medicine that are higher risk, to practice in rural areas that may have more high risk, this is what we're going to do, doctors. We're going to prohibit you from getting punitive damage coverage, and we're going to uncap any punitive damages so you're out there on your own. I don't think that is consistent with what the legislature was trying to accomplish in Section 1.02 when it passes. I think
what is there legislative history discussing the evidence of doctors not practicing in Texas because of anything other than insurance?
There is of lawsuits. There's discussion, if you go to the legislative history, about certain areas being higher risk, the obstetrical, the neurosurgery, that some doctors were either leaving those areas, they were not delivering babies because of the risk of having grievous damage wards. And we're having, again, if you look at all the factors, you can see the same thing that's being applied today. And one of the things that we've, some of the amicus briefs that I think are very telling is that in 1995, the average nursing home verdict was $100,000. In 96, it was $264,000. In 97, it was $10 million. And as and the public policy that various groups have put in there, what's happening to the insurance, the number of insurers admitted writing nursing home coverage has gone from 8 to 1 now. That the rates, Texas has the second highest rates.
But none of this was before the legislature when the statute was enacted, so it was really not of concern to us, correct? In interpreting the legislative intent.
Correct, but if you're interpreting consistent with what the legislature was trying to accomplish back in 1977, which was a crisis, we believe the same factors are applicable today, that there is a crisis, and that part of the way to solve this crisis is to implement what the legislature, we believe, tried to do in 1977. One other area was the question of whether or not insurers were paying for punitive damage claims prior to 1977. I believe there's only one case decided under Texas law, I think it was the Dairy Lane case, as to whether or not insurers could cover punitive damages pre-1977, and all the case law, I think the only case law, was that it was not against public policy for medical insurers or any insurer back in that time period to provide coverage for punitive damage. In fact, as we sit here today, I believe there's been only one decision that's raised the question of it being against public policy, and that was a case that came out of the Northern District of Dallas in 1998, Powell versus Parker.
But regardless, as a part of this Medical Improvement Liability Act, the legislature did express it is against public policy for insurers to insure against punitive damage.
I don't know if they said it was against public policy. I think they said it was one method to address the crisis as far as the cost of insurance as it existed. And one way to relieve that is to slice out certain parts of coverage.
But also to hold the provider personally responsible.
And to hold the provider. We've had cases that came out in the court, the Safeway Store versus American Home Insurance in 1987, where the court, despite this provision, said in Texas, it's still not against public policy to insure punitive damages.
One quick question. Do you agree with Mr. Fillmore that the issue is not before this court as to whether or not the trial court was correct in multiplying by 4 the jury's uncapped actual damages award of $2.37 million?
41.007, which was in effect at the time this case arose, said that the cap was 4 times the actual damages found by the trier fact. And there have been other cases that tell that. There have been other cases dealing with Chapter 33, which has similar language, which says basically you look at the actual damages found by the trier fact, and that was what was to be used in the reduction, multiplication, or whatever. And that's why that report was not brought.
Any other
questions? Has not brought.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in today's cases, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court.